Okay, good morning, October 1st, 2024. Appreciate folks showing up. I'm glad to be here, breathing, and breathing mindfully to the best of my ability. We will start with some period of meditation and then, so I will discuss the Dharma and recovery. So it looks like people have ceased arriving. So although I usually keep an eye out for late arrivals, hope everyone is well this morning. So settling back into your meditation posture. And you can close your eyes or just lower your gaze. Turning the attention inward. Bringing awareness to the body. Feeling the body at rest and stillness. The stillness of the body supports stillness of the mind. And feel the body breathing. Breathing in, breathing out. And letting the breath in its natural way just settle the body, releasing any points of tension or tightness, softening the jaw. Relaxing the shoulders, and breathing into the belly, opening. And when we are able to follow these simple guidelines, it can be a pleasant settling that happens right away. Other times, the mind might be more busy or there might be more stress, and we find there's a kind of resistance to letting go. With mindfulness, we try to just be aware of whatever is arising. So we make this gentle effort, this inclination of the mind towards the quieting and calming. But we recognize that we're not in control. We are participating in our experience, in how our experience unfolds. But we can't exactly control it. So we come to this practice with a sense of acceptance and openness, curiosity. How is it right now? How is my heart mind right now? And then we continue to gently bring it back if the mind is wandering, release tension. So it's not that we just give up, and if we find distraction or agitation in the mind or body, we just don't create a conflict with it. Try to, in a sense, cooperate with whatever is arising. And using the breath as our companion, as our guide, as our anchor, and indeed as a way of working with energy. The breath has a naturally calming quality when we are sitting. Breath can be stimulating in other circumstances, but here we try to use it for its calming qualities. The attitude we bring to this process is informed by loving kindness. Without explicitly practicing a form of metta, we nonetheless try to bring this attitude, perspective of kindness, gentleness. We could call this forgiveness in the sense that we are forgiving ourselves for being imperfect meditators. And we can bring compassion to ourselves when there is an inner struggle, to see that this existence itself has difficult elements to it, is challenging. And those who are facing difficulties and challenges deserve compassion, deserve care, kindness. All of this, in a sense, is contained in our mindfulness. Holding our experience with the soft, gentle, caring attitude. There's no arriving in our meditation. There's just constant flow, change. We may get to a point where we feel settled or clear-eyed, clear-minded. And then a few minutes later, we're off, distracted again. And sometimes there is a sense of a process of settling, which is pleasant and to be appreciated, cultivated. The challenge is to just stay with it, stay with the pleasant, the unpleasant moments of mindfulness, the moments of distraction, and to persist in effort and gentle, kind effort. Okay. I usually check the time right when we start to sit. So I track the 20 minutes that way, but I kind of forgot to that time. So I don't know exactly how long we sat. It was very close to 20 minutes. So I hope everyone is well and safe, given that we live in a world that is unsafe in many ways, and many ways can become unwell, internally and externally, mentally and physically. I was listening to a wonderful Dharma talk from Ajahn Amaro yesterday, and I recommend, if you like to listen to Dharma talks, I'll put his name in the chat, just so that people who aren't familiar with him. So, Ajahn Amaro. Ajahn is the honorific for someone who's been a monk for 10 years, 10 rains retreats. And he actually has a, they put his talks into a podcast, which is something I'm working on actually for myself. Reminds me, I need to send an email about that. So you can just like get his talks if you listen to podcasts, go on a podcast, your podcast app, and search Ajahn Amaro. So this talk was, the title was something like, "When should we let go and when should we hold on?" And a very interesting topic, and certainly relevant for people in recovery, for a variety of reasons. First of all, for the obvious one, that addiction starts with letting go. But then there are other aspects of recovery that demand us to hold on, hold on to our recovery. One of the things that Ajahn Amaro pointed out was, people think of, well, spirituality is all about letting go. But he was like, well, the Buddha, that's not what he was doing all the time. One of the paramitas, the perfections, is persistence, and that persistence is really, about holding on to something, holding on to a discipline, to a commitment, and that's very much what our recovery is about holding on to that, and that's it, so it we kind of come to this question of what are we talking about, like what does if the cause of suffering is clinging and craving, then how can there be things that we hold on to or that we cling to? It really comes down, as so many things do, to intention. What are we trying to accomplish, and particularly the inner experience, because we can cling to our sobriety in a way that's really not helpful, right? The white knuckling, we call it, right? And so it's not that sticking with recovery is automatically a good thing. I mean, I can't say that. I suppose it's better to white knuckle than to not knuckle at all, or whatever. But the idea, the point being that we can cause suffering to ourselves, even in our sobriety or our recovery, by the way we relate to it. And I certainly feel that I hold on to my meditation practice very persistently. That's something that I do on a daily basis, and it serves me. And I don't freak out if it doesn't, all fall in place. In fact, this morning I had a experience. I had a feel. And normally, when I meditate, I turn off the ringer on my phone. But I had a feeling this morning, partly because I'd been reading about Southern Dharma, and I had the vibrate function on, and indeed, after a relatively short period of time, my phone started to vibrate, and it was my 86-year-old brother calling, and I think that it's wise to not cling to my meditation when my big brother calls, and had a very rich conversation with him, quite touching on, from my view, certain spiritual topics. He may not have known that they were spiritual topics. It's not his orientation. But in fact, the first thing he started talking about was an article he'd read about how many people are dying from fentanyl. So there was that. But so it felt like, oh, this is a time when I need to let go, and not, even though this thing that I'm doing is wholesome, and I had that experience, of course, when my daughter was small, and she would come down sometimes when I was meditating and climb in my lap, and I would sort of think, okay, well, my meditation's over, and that's okay. So I think it's a really helpful reflection. What am I holding on to that's helpful, and what am I clinging to that's causing suffering? And in the same way, what am I letting go of that's wholesome, and what am I letting go of that's not? Because there can be this sort of false spirituality, like, oh, I'm just letting go, I really don't care. And w where what's really happening is we're being apathetic, or we don't want to feel something, or we don't want to face something, or deal with the effort in something. It's sort of like, oh, it really doesn't matter to me. And maybe it does, but you'd rather not go through the, facing the difficulties to accomplish something. This was very much my way of operating, particularly before I got sober. Especially, it's one of the important parts for me of recovery, which is learning to show up and stick with something. And indeed, one of my false spiritual strategies before I got sober was to say, oh, I'm just going to let it go. Where what I was doing really was giving up. And recovery taught me about, oh, just keep showing up one day at a time. Because that letting go was often actually just an expression of impatience. Like, oh, if it doesn't happen right away, forget it. And not realizing that, oh, if you just keep showing up day after day and keeping going a little bit, persisting, whether it's like looking for a job, or working on some project, or going to school, the various things in life that take time. That was one of the big lessons for me of recovery. It's a beautiful lesson. Oftentimes, when I am asked to speak at a meeting and they ask for a topic, the topic that I suggest is showing up, because I feel like showing up has been the key to my recovery. And here I am with you guys. I'm showing up today. I, not to pat myself on the back, but I've been doing this for a few years, showing up on this Zoom call. But one of the things that came up for me as I was listening to Ajahn Amro is a particular topic that shows up sometimes when people get involved in recovery. And then, they go to an AA meeting where everybody says, hi, my name's Joe and I'm an alcoholic. I'm Kevin, I'm an alcoholic. And they'll come to the Buddhist group and say, well, I don't want to Say I'm an alcoholic because I feel like that's clinging to an identity. And with Buddhism, you're supposed to let go of clinging to identities. And I've had this conversation multiple times in the last 20, 25 years, because I do continue to identify as an alcoholic. And that's how I like to say it now, because I think some of the language that we have now around race and gender is very helpful in terms of identifying as and seeing that as a choice. So I'll say to people, I identify as a recovering alcoholic, or I identify as an alcoholic. So what I'm saying is, like, I'm not saying that I've been diagnosed as an alcoholic, or that that's even really important, but that what helps me live my life is to intentionally take on this identity, which means that just the fact that there is intention behind it, that there is awareness, that there is mindfulness behind that choice, means that it's not clinging to self. It's not clinging to an identity. It's utilizing identity, because we all have identities. And my, I don't know if it's a joke, but my line that I'll use with people when they say, well, I don't want to take on that identity of being an alcoholic, I'll say, well, when you let go of all your other identities, why don't you let go of this? Because we all walk around with a bunch of identities which are functional, and so, to some degree or other, they are helpful or unhelpful. And what I think the insight into not self, the most useful way to employ that is to investigate, inquire into the identities that you carry. And then what's your relationship to those identities? Is it helpful or is it unhelpful? Is there clinging that causes suffering, or is there an openness or a helpful functionality? Is there a way, as with saying I'm an alcoholic, that it's a good reminder to me, oh yeah, I am an alcoholic. Okay, I don't drink. Like, it doesn't matter if I say that I'm an alcoholic or not. The important point is that I don't drink, and I know that that I don't want to drink, and that I believe that it would be highly disruptive and destructive to my life if I did drink. But the quick way to kind of get that message through to my consciousness and to the world around me, if I have to say, if I need to assert my reasons for not drinking, is to say I'm an alcoholic, and it functions in that way. I mean, obviously, what constitutes an alcoholic is quite, variable. There's no, you can get definitions, but that's just something that somebody made up, right? And so, and I, I could easily argue that I'm not an alcoholic, by lots of people's definitions, but it helps me to be an alcoholic. It's the old thing, I'm a grateful alcoholic. Like, so this is a case where, Amaro wasn't talking about identity, about clinging to identity. But this is a classic case of how clinging, or maybe I'll say attachment to something, has a wholesome outcome. I mean, we can talk about the precepts, following the precepts has a wholesome quality to it, and clinging to that. And there is a way in which people will use Buddhist ideas like letting go and not self in unwholesome and destructive ways. Everything is empty. And so if I'm drunk, I'm just like drunk Buddha, silly justifications like that. And I'm not just making that up. That's not hyperbole. That's real stuff that people do. And it's tragic. And there's been, there are terrible things that have happened around those kind of delusions. So it's really important. I mean, the middle way is a really beautiful guide for us. And to ask ourselves, am I practicing in a balanced and middle way? Am I viewing myself and my behavior in a balanced way that's not going to extremes? And Ajahn Amaro was talking about some of the ascetic extremes that he went to early in his practice. He had chosen not to eat anything outside of the one meal a day. In the Theravada monastic tradition, they can have what are called allowables outside of the regular meal time. And they're like things that, it's very technical and it's sort of funny, but a lot of it's about sugar, actually. So they can have tea and sugar and stuff. But he was like, no, outside of the, early in his practice, early in his monastic life, he decided to take on this more rigorous practice of just one meal a day and the rest of the time only water. And at one point, after doing this for a couple of years, he was with Ajahn Sumedho, his teacher, and they had gone to some event, and somebody handed them some chocolate-covered caramel or something that was apparently allowable. And he said Ajahn Sumedho turned to him and held it out to him, and that he caught his eyes. He looked, Sumedho looked in his eyes, and Ajahn Amaro knew that Ajahn Sumedho knew that he was following this particular practice, right? And he'd been doing it for a while. And that what Ajahn Sumedho was saying is like, don't cling to that idea, to that, oh, I'm a really serious monk because I don't eat anything. I only have water outside the meal. And Amaro took it and ate it, and said it was like a really important teaching for him. Because and Sumedho then referred to another monk who had been going to these extremes. Who's like, I was afraid we had another one of those Santachitas with us. Who was like, there's one of the things that the monks take on is they don't lie down at all. So of the three four postures, they don't use the lying down posture, and this monk, he kept falling asleep. He kept like he would be in his kuti and he would fall asleep and wind up like lying down. So he wound up like tying himself to the pillar in the meditation hall to sleep. And so people would come in the morning, like to for the morning puja, and here's this monk like snoring, leaning up against the pole, tied up to the pole. And I was like, dude, really? Stop. Interesting, just the things people get attached to, right? Because what he thought he was doing was letting go of lying down. But then what happened was he got attached to sitting up. So we can see how this happens, right? We're like, oh, this is all good, good, good. I'll do more of this because this is really good. I'll do even more because it's so good. And then finally you're like, oops, I'm gone off the edge there. And that's how I view recovery, is very much about this balance. And we've all probably seen people who go to extremes in their recovery. I mean, I often tell the story of this, there was a sponsor guru in the Bay Area that had this very strict policy. If you were one of his sponsees, anytime you had a difficult feeling, you were supposed to stop Write an inventory, pray, and meditate. Great. It's in the steps. That makes sense. Basically, it's 10th step. And people start who like, this became a kind of culty thing where people, oh, we're the people that do this, the pod people. And one of them, a young woman who had dropped out of high school and had been sober for 6 or 7 years and was like, really, her life was really improving. And she got into school and she actually was going to Berkeley. And one day I hear that in a meeting that she's left school because she had found that she kept having difficult feelings, as one does when one goes to college. And she'd have to stop and write her inventory and meditate. And then she couldn't keep going to class with all this stuff. And I was like, my head explodes, right? I'm like, no, this is not wisdom. This is not recovery. This is not working the steps. This is obsessive, right? But we do, this is what we do, right? That's why we're addicts, right? That's why we meet together and talk about recovery, because we need to catch ourselves from these traps that we build for ourselves, that we dig for ourselves, that we wind up, we're just going right in the good direction, and we just keep going there until we fall off the edge. It's like, no, don't keep going. So I think it's a valuable reflection. What are we? What to hold to? What to let go of? And as with really most serious spiritual questions, there isn't an answer. That's why it's like, oh, you have to know, you have to explore for yourself and investigate for yourself what is most useful, what is most wholesome. And this is where mindfulness is so important for us, why it's the key to all of this work, is to be able to turn inside and see, how does this feel? To me, that's like number one. It's not the only source of information, but it's the number one source of information. Oh, how does this feel? Does this feel comfortable? Does this feel balanced? And then, as the teachings tell us, then we also consult with a wise person, our friend or companion or partner or sponsor or spiritual guide. Does this seem wholesome? Does this seem wise? Am I going too far? Am I clinging too much? Am I letting go too much? So I hope this was of some benefit this morning, and I'll open it up for anyone who wanted to comment. I should also mention that I have a new book, which probably most of you know. It is started to sell. The fun thing about publishing on Amazon is I actually get to see every day how many books sell. If you publish with a publisher every 6 months, they tell you something, but it's very difficult to interpret what they're telling you. Anyway, we'll just put that link in there into the chat in case you have not seen this. It's called Sought Through Meditation, Exploring. Oh, God, I don't know why Amazon gives this ridiculous link. Oh, I went in through my author self. That didn't work. Anyway, maybe Monica can find a better link than I'm finding. But it's called Sought Through Meditation, Exploring Step 11 Through the Lens of Dharma. It's actually very small. I just have the proof copy here. Just a little over 130 pages, and pretty nice read, I think, and really just about meditation and working with the practice. And I have sort of the story of my own practice, my practice history, which I like to entertain people a little bit with some stories. So it's But hope you'll explore that. Oh, hands are up. Flo, great. Hi. Oh, how's things in Georgia?
We're good. North Atlanta, not so much, but one thing is your book, the new one I run a recovery Dharma meeting in my area because I'm south of Atlanta, and it's out of a clubhouse, so a lot of us are 12-steppers as well. So we are going to be using your book. So many of them just bought that book because it's an we call it an 11-step meeting. So
I was just thinking this morning, this could become like the recovery Dharma might really go wild for this book. So, yay.
I'm hopeful because I did start reading it and I really, really do enjoy it. But I was sitting here listening to your talk, and it was very timely. I had another like health flare happen in the last few days, and I was like gonna be I had this whole plan of being like super strict and like super like I'm gonna like overhaul all these things. And listening to your talk, I'm like, okay, I might be clinging a little too much.
Boy.
I haven't had a chance to talk it out yet with my wise friend, my sponsor. And I was like, well, this was a timely discussion. And I was giggling because it's so true. I think, like you said, most of us, I even with like yoga in the beginning, that became my program at first. And so just thank you for the very timely topic.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks. It's nice to see you, Flo. I'm glad you're doing okay. You know, I don't know. I think I told Elise that we're going to be teaching that same retreat we did this year up in Indiana next August. So maybe you can come up for that one.
I'm on the wait list, or I'm on the list to get notified.
Okay, excellent. Oh yeah, and there's Ganel, who was with us too. Yeah, who was there? Eric, you're in the place of past disasters,
No,
no current disasters, as far as I know.
don't have any current disasters. My name is Eric. I am an alcoholic and aloha from Hawaii. It's a beautiful day here today, actually.
Yeah, that's unusual.
There's a reason I like to live in paradise.
Yeah, it's pretty sweet.
Well, I'm just glad to be here with you all this morning. And I love what you said, Kevin, about I suppose it's better to white knuckle than not to knuckle
I
it
don't know where I
at
come up with these brilliant
all. Well, I'm gonna
aphorisms
steal
to not
that
knuckle at all.
one. But you know what you were discussing today just kind of reminds me of humility and ego, and when we're talking about the literature, and I think it's in the 12 into 12 where they use the term big shotism, and I feel like we could have a whole chapter devoted to small shotism also, because it's
Right,
so
yes.
difficult for me to
Yes.
walk that line between oh, I'm the greatest in the world, or I'm the biggest piece of poop ever, and it can shift so easily. And so what I find is that I experience the phenomenon of craving in just about every activity I do, it seems like, and once I get a hit of something, I want more of it, and it's usually something that makes me feel good that I'm going to cling to. But it's not necessarily because I seem to be addicted to destructive and negative thinking. And so in my meditation, when that's going, I'm like, can I just think something nice? And if I do, I'm like, ah, and I can have a tendency to sit on that. So I appreciate what you were saying about finding the middle way, and I guess that's what this is all about, but it's really difficult to navigate that, at least for me, but the more I do it, yeah, the easier it gets. I don't know. I'll tell you, I was in Colorado Springs over last week on a convention, and I did a deprivation chamber, and it was a really great experience. It was an hour of meditation and complete dark. I couldn't tell if my eyes were open or closed. And then I did a cold plunge after that, and I left that place just feeling so good. And I'm like, is this what it's going to take, every day for me
I
to
found the key. My
do?
new drug.
Anyway, I don't know if there's a question or anything in there worth commenting on, but I just wanted to speak up and
Yeah.
say hi. So thanks for letting me share.
Yeah, good to hear from you, Eric. And I know, I mean, I think you brought up a lot of great topics. And you know, I always use this image of the middle way is not just a straight line. It's not like when the cops pull you over and you have to walk the straight line. It's more like a tightrope walker who is constantly going like this and correcting and correcting. It's not that like, oh, I've got it figured out. Like I'm just like always, we get these slight imbalances and ideally, if we are paying attention and if we are, have a good sort of system of care and attention, we start to notice the imbalance before it becomes really destructive. And then we're able to like, oh, okay, that's a little much, and this is, one of my sort of theories, shall we say, about mindfulness is that what it's doing is it's making us less tolerant of suffering. It makes us, as we become more attuned to our inner life, we pick up the dukkha at an earlier point. And because we've learned that, like, oh, this is I don't have to do this. I can let go. We let go more easily, right? This is sort of one of the principles of recovery, that as we come into sobriety, we start to notice, oh, like my diet's not so good either, and oh, I need some exercise, and oh, my sexuality is unwholesome, and on and on, right? Because we're becoming more sensitive and more attuned just by being sober. But when you practice mindfulness, that's like extra sober, it's extra attuned. And so we can, this is, equanimity, right? Is this balanced state. And it's kind of what you see in a really mature monastic is this way in which they really don't get far off. They're still correcting. They're still correcting, but they don't. It's not like these, swings that ordinary people fall into, and certainly addicts tend to fall into. But this is one of the real values of mindfulness, is to keep us attuned to what's it, when we're off balance. Yeah. So there, I see Robin's asking about the audio, and I actually have scheduled the recording studio time to do an audiobook of Sought Through Meditation. So, my friend Mickey, who I don't think is here this week, I didn't see her, although she could be if I dive into the second page. Anyway, she is visually impaired and sort of was asking about it last week, which is, so that motivated me to contact the studio where I recorded Living Kindness, and they're actually much more affordable than the place where I recorded One Breath at a Time was wound up being very expensive. But anyway, it's all worked out. Any other comments or, you know what? I actually need to go. It's 11. I told my wife I would give her a ride. And next week, I'm going to be traveling next Tuesday, and it's possible that I could be here. But as I was thinking about balance, I realized it might be more wise. I'm going to ask Greg Pergament to teach the class. If he can't, then we'll see if we can come up with somebody else. Great. Which shouldn't be difficult because there are some great people around. And so I probably won't see you guys next Tuesday. I'll be on my way to the Buddhist Recovery Network conference, which I don't know if any of you are coming, but looking forward
Wow.
to that. Yeah.
So just whoever it is, just get them in touch with me.
Will do.
And I'll help them get on.
Thank you. Beautiful. All right, guys. Wonderful to be with you all. And everyone stays safe and healthy and sober.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you, Kevin.
Peace. Bye bye.
Yeah.